shipping is responsible for about 3% of total greenhouse gas emissions. And that doesn't sound like a huge amount, but it's comparable to Japan or Germany or significant developed countries. Scotland has become a hub for green energy transition. There's also a strong nature thrust in Scotland as well. It's a very progressive country in understanding opportunities for new innovation. We do have a technology, we do have a lot of private investors who are prepared to go for the long haul, but generally speaking, to get to scale at the speed that we need to get to scale to address the planetary health challenges, we do need to see some public money, some government support.
From the first-time founders to the funds that back them, innovation needs different. Our episode partner, HSBC Innovation Banking, is proud to accelerate growth for tech and life science businesses, creating meaningful connections and opening up a world of opportunity for entrepreneurs and investors alike. Discover more at www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb. Hello and welcome to the UKTM podcast, a weekly chat with the movers and shakers of the UK tech industry and the destination for all things UK tech related. I'm your host, Jane Wakefield, and joining me this week is Diane Gilpin, the founder and CEO of Smart Green Shipping, a company that is developing wind-powered solutions for the shipping industry. Welcome, Diane.
Hi, Jane. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, let's kick off by putting this company that you run into context before we get down to what it is that you guys are doing. So what really is the sort of scale of the problem with emissions in the shipping industry? And is it something that's affecting our air quality, or is this about the oceans? What are the problems?
I mean, it's both and other things. So shipping is responsible for about 3% of total greenhouse gas emissions. And that doesn't sound like a huge amount, but it's comparable to Japan or Germany or significant developed countries. Now, obviously, ships are travelling across the ocean, but when they're close to land, the fuel that is used is particularly dirty, low sulphur fuel, but some of it's high sulphur, but mostly not very good quality fuel, issuing a lot of particulate. So it does affect air quality. It is responsible for premature deaths, particularly in port towns around the world. And of course, we've got a lot of discharge coming out of vessels when they're on the high seas. So, it's a bit invisible. We can't see all that stuff going on out there. So that toxicity does affect biodiversity in oceans. So it's a significant global problem. And it's a bit hidden from us because it's all offshore. It tends to be a forgotten space. Unlike, aviation, where we're very familiar with it, but we tend as a global community to not be so aware of shipping as we are of some of the other modes of transport.
One thing that kind of highlighted to me the issue is I got invited to go on one of these sort of super hotels, floating hotel boats. I think it was the first $1 billion ship, but just as a hotel creates an awful lot of waste, so this floating hotels seem to do the same. I mean, why have we got these things, and are they a really huge part of the problem?
I don't know if they're a huge part of the problem, but they are part of the problem. I think because there's a perception that it's because it's a floating at sea solution, it's better than aviation. But I have seen, I don't remember off the top of my head, but reports to say that aviation is lower carbon. If you want to get to, Southampton to Gibraltar on one of those floating hotels, then your emission footprint is higher than it would be if you flew, because of all of those hotel emissions, just the kind of, the waste, air emissions, all of it. And of course, it's a very kind of luxury experience. So you can't just go and sit on a ferry. You've got casinos and slides and spas and all sorts of other lovely things. So I think that's part of the problem. But there are something like between 60 and 100,000 ships in the global fleet. And I don't know what proportion of them are cruise ships, but, you know, significant majority of those ships, so 40,000 ships, are dry bulkers and tankers. And they are moving the building blocks of our consumerist society. So they're bringing production materials, grains, those sorts of dry goods, and also fuel. They're moving a lot of fossil fuels. Something like 40% of the global fleet is moving fossil fuels. So the cruise vessels are a very public interface, but behind that, there's a lot of raw materials being moved in bulkers and tankers that we never see. They're kind of hidden behind security at ports around the world.
And of course, all these cargo ships bringing in crate loads of goods from China and other places, cheap consumer goods. So let's talk a little bit about the solution and what it is that your company is doing. So you've got both hardware and software. I see you're sitting behind what looks a bit like an aircraft wing, but obviously isn't that. So describe what it is and how that the hardware part of the story fits in.
Basically, that's a sail. It does look very much like a wing. It's made out of aluminium, but instead of being horizontal, it's vertical, and it captures the wind and it helps push ships through the water. So it's a fundamentally simple solution. It provides thrust. It's not the whole power for the ship. It works in conjunction with the fuel that the ship is operating. Now, at the moment, that's fossils. As we look into the future, that might be some alternative, but none of those alternative fuels are yet widely available. So this technology is available so we can start to reduce the amount of fuel used and therefore reduce greenhouse gas emissions and other pollutants as, you know, a kind of very short-term reduction in contribution from the global fleet. You know, that's the basics, but it's also intelligent. It's automated, so it knows which way the wind is coming from. It spins on a ring at the base to optimize the wind direction, and it will retract if the wind is too much and it's creating a health risk, or if it's too little and you're needing more power to push the engine, which is now pushing the ship through the water, but it's got some resistance, we bring the wing down. It also enables it to get in and out of port and to allow access to the cargo hold. So it's simply a sail, but it's a 21st century sail. So it's automated and it knows when the wind's coming, where it's coming from, and when it needs to get out of the way, so that we don't need to have, you know, the kind of highly skilled sailing community that we had in days of yore when, you know, sailing ships were everywhere. So this is a solution that's based on 21st century technology, but basic, using the wind to generate power for ships.
I love it because it's both simple but also quite futuristic. And I like the idea of tech that sort of is very obvious and simple to use, but is going to potentially have revolutionize things, because that's going to make ships look very different, isn't it? You know, if we start seeing those on ships around the world, that sort of completely changes our kind of idea of what a ship looks like, a bit like kids who have no idea when they draw a phone, they draw a little rectangle rather than the old-fashioned phones we used to pick up. So what kind of ships will it go on, and how many of these sails will a sort of typical cargo ship need?
Yeah, just to touch on that point about simplicity, when I just went into, why don't we use wind in shipping? Because we've got 8,000 years of heritage of doing that. So that's not going to be a difficult transition to make. And it turns out that it was quite difficult. And so it's the power that we're using that's available, abundant, exclusively to the ships that you might own and operate. But the technology is more complicated because we engaged with the shipping industry and they said, oh, no, we can't have sail because we can't, you know, we can't get in and out of port in the 21st century, we can't do this. So because we've worked with ship owners, we've introduced this kind of space age technology into this very simple power solution that we're all familiar with using. And I think, you know, what we're looking at is installing on ships which have a clear deck space. So they are the ships that I was referring to earlier, the carriers of raw materials rather than the finished consumer goods that will come in a container vessel. So right. They're all the various components that we need in an industrial society to make up things. And more equally importantly, other consumer goods like coffee and wine and chocolate and those things come in these. So, you know, there's a self-interest in getting these things to be decarbonized.
So I understand that this is being sort of developed on the land and in a place which also has a rich history, the shipyards of the Clyde. So is this now becoming an area of Scotland that has this industrial past, that has this history of shipping, that is kind of embracing climate tech, and has the whole kind of area become a bit of a little pocket for this type of technology, or are you an outlier here?
I think we're an outlier in the shipping space, but I would say that Scotland has become a hub for green energy transition. There's also a strong nature thrust in Scotland as well. It's a very progressive country in understanding opportunities for new innovation and for supporting them. For me personally, Scotland was tremendously supportive of a woman in innovation trying to raise funds. It was tremendously difficult to do that. I mean, climate tech is that what we had to do was to build something that cost millions of pounds to test it so that the market would get confidence in it. So that was, you know, that was a big challenge. You know, we're about 24 months away from market, so revenues aren't forthcoming. So most traditional, and it's perfectly understandable, investors are saying, you know, it's too big and too far from generating returns. And I mean, no one said this to me specifically, but it, you know, being a woman in this engineering and energy space is quite unusual. So finding support may or may not have been more difficult. But Scotland was really welcoming, and we did a lot of work at COP26, talked to a lot of companies, a lot of organisations, and Scottish Enterprise have supported us there. And that does enable us to avail ourselves of the skills and technology that are available on the Clyde, not only for maritime, although that's important, there's a lot of Royal Navy stuff that goes on up there, but also for renewables. They're doing a lot in onshore and offshore wind. So when you start to think about offshore wind, offshore wind turbine, so that's not that different from a wing sail on a ship that's operating offshore. So robustness of the technology, how it works in hostile environments, all of those things are already being developed around the offshore wind industry. So that there's a lot of crossover and benefit in being in that place. So
And with the money and the investment you have from Scottish Enterprise Fund, do you think that, because you said that, you know, it's quite hard for traditional investors to see beyond a certain time frame, and a lot of this stuff, not just climate tech, but a lot of tech innovations, you know, you're talking years, aren't you, and lots of research. So is it government money that's going to become more and more important, do you think, in funding these types of businesses?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think it's a societal, well, I don't think, I'm confident that it's a societal challenge that we address pollution in all of its forms. And that's not what motivates traditional investors. And we do have a technology, we do have a lot of private investors who are prepared to go for the long haul. But generally speaking, to get to scale at the speed that we need to get to scale to address the planetary health challenges, we do need to see some public money, some government support for these big tech, energy tech transition activities. Because I just don't think that we can expect private investors to support this. They have clear criteria, maximum amount of funds that they will allocate, how close you are to market readiness, those sorts of metrics. We, not only us, but big climate tech innovation just can't hit those, you know, criteria.
HSBC Innovation Banking, our partner for this episode, provides commercial banking services, expertise, and insights to the technology, life science and healthcare, private equity, and venture capital industries. To find out why innovation needs different, go to www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb. So what would your advice be for Peter Kyle, who's obviously come into, we've got a new Labour government, Peter Kyle is the sort of tech minister. He's already talked about the importance of putting tech sort of at the heart of the agenda and using AI more in government and making the Department of Science, Innovation and Technology a much more central part of the government's policy. So would you have specific advice for him on investment and how the government can kind of help improve that scene?
Yeah, I mean, it's very obvious to me that it's got to be cross-department, because we are very heavily supported by one of the largest, well, probably the largest renewable company in the UK, which is Drax, importing biomass into the UK to produce low-carbon electricity. So we're cross-sectoring, we're crossing into the energy, we're crossing into Ed Miliband's department with the great British energy supply chain. How do we support that with low-carbon shipping? So it's using renewables to move renewables. But I think in terms of innovation, what we're able to demonstrate is that in the UK, we have a particularly strong contingent cohort of expertise in wind, in offshore renewables, but also in yachting and leisure yachts. So we work with the University of Southampton. That's one of the most, you know, it's the preeminent university for looking at how wind can be optimized. They do a lot of work with America's Cup teams. We work with naval architects. And so I envision a knowledge centre in the UK where we could be creating this technology and exporting it. So in doing so, we are reducing emissions globally, but we're also creating jobs and skills in the UK, which has got to be beneficial. I mean, I think one of the things that's been really depressing in previous years has been that the green transition, the energy transition, is depicted as a cost. If you start to use less fuel on your ship because you've installed a wind device, you've reduced your cost. So I think that's, you know, it's a bit of a fallacy to be suggesting that that the green transition is going to be more costly. My argument is it's more costly to do nothing.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Now, as well as the investment from the Scottish government, you've also got investment from a Japanese shipping company. Is that sort of important to get that kind of balance right, so that you're getting money from the sort of almost the source, you know, these are the people that you're targeting, as well as money from government? Or is it all just, well, it's just money and we're just going to spend it, doesn't really matter where it comes from?
Well, I'm very grateful to everybody who's contributed and invested, but where it's been tremendously helpful, and both the Scottish Enterprise have invested, they've given us a grant, but they've also equity invested alongside MOL Dry Bulk. And where that has been tremendously valuable is the knowledge and experience that both of those organisations can bring to us as, you know, a leadership team. So MOL are operating 300 or 400 ships around the world. So they can be really practical about, well, actually, Di, that's not going to work. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if you come into port and you do this, this is just going to be in the way, or those sorts of things, or, you know, shipping community is not going to buy that sort of solution. And the Scottish Enterprise board member has a lot of experience of young startups, what works, what's successful. And so they give us a lot of good advice about, you know, share option schemes and, you know, how to support your emerging team where, you know, we're working incredibly hard. And, you know, how do we get a good, I'm very keen to have a good internal culture. But that's very difficult when you've got deadline after deadline after deadline. And I go, well, it'd be great to have a 4-day week, but up until then, can you just do 7? You know, that's kind of where we're at. So they're very helpful with support on training and how do we recruit the best people? How do we keep the good people in the company? So they're good at that. But we also have Drax, who are a cargo owner, as a, you know, supporter of the company, and they're able to say, you can't just go slower because we need this cargo here on Wednesday, otherwise the lights go out. So, you know, we have that part of the conversation to be considering. And we got some funding from Innovate UK to install the land-based rig onto a ship, which we're in the middle of doing now. So we'll have it on a ship before the end of the year, so we can demonstrate that to the shipping community that it works.
And very briefly, before we sort of talk a bit more about sort of the tech ecosystem, this isn't just about hardware, it's about software, isn't it? So what role does the software play in your offering?
So we've got obviously the compounder control systems that are automating the rigs, but we're also developing an automated routing system, which says, so most ships go A to B, B on a great circle route. And if you slightly move off that route, you can use less fuel, generate more energy from wind, and still arrive at the same time. And it's kind of a bit paradoxical, it kind of messes with your head a bit. You go further, but you can go faster. So because we've got decades of historical data, and we've got very clever algorithms which import weather forecast data, we can optimize the route that a wind enabled ship can use to increase the benefit of having wind on the ship.
21st century navigation charts as well as 21st century sails. I like it.
It is great. We got some very, very valuable support from the European Space Agency. So, you know, it's rocket science to some extent. So it's very simple technology, but it's also employing rocket science and, you know, satellite data and clever algorithms. That was a really exciting piece of the work is the software.
Now, I wanted to ask you a little bit about sort of culture, because you hinted earlier about, you know, how it's difficult for startups. You know, so you would like everybody to work a 4-day week. You want everybody to sort of have a good work-life balance. But the nature of startups is that you kind of are scrabbling to get things finished, and, you know, you're starting things, so it takes a long time. So how do you sort of get that balance right? Because I know you're quite passionate as well about mental health, and climate anxiety is a real thing, as is just mental health in startups worrying because you don't quite know how settled your job is. So how do you manage all of that for your staff?
Oh, best I can. Don't know how well I do it, and I don't, you know, but the first thing is to be aware that it is a challenge, and to be open to the team to talk about any challenges they have. I also try to identify if it feels like someone's under pressure, and to try and figure out how we can put support in place. Having said that, we've got a lot of very, very committed people. They're not a lot. We haven't got a lot of people, but the people we have got are very committed. And we see ourselves as climate activists. So that term is often, I don't know, a kind of Just Stop Oil, orange paint type thing. But the real activism is navigating our way through the complexity of change. And that's about building relationships with each other in the team. So our real job is about navigating change, and it's about building relationships and bringing everybody with us. So we work across the whole shipping ecosystem. And within that, there are some quite conservative with a small C voices. There are also some climate skeptics. So it's really important that we recognise just how mentally challenging it is to have to deal with alternative viewpoints to our own. And so we do have regular meetings so we can decompress. We work with the International Futures Forum, which is an organisation looking at systems change and how we need to have human resilience in this kind of transition that we're all going through. So I have to say that, you know, I'd like to do much more, but we're always balancing just suboptimal budgets for R&D technology when you don't know when you're going to, you know, don't know what the hardware is going to cost, with recruiting excellent people who are committed but just not having quite enough resource to make it possible to take the pressure off everybody. So yeah, it's difficult.
And you've also mentioned about being a woman in tech. You've been in the game for a long time, and I wondered whether you'd seen any improvements over that time, or whether things are still as hard as they were sort of 20 odd years ago.
Yeah, there are improvements. I'm seeing more women in groups of startups In shipping, not so much. I'm not, as you say, I've been around a while. I'm often the youngest person in a room, which is quite amazing given my age, and also one of the only women, maybe two other women in the room. So that's kind of challenging. And when I say to shipping colleagues, oh, you know, here I am, you'll be able to tell who I am, I'm the woman, and they go, oh, you have to get used to it, that's shipping. But we are seeing a much stronger commitment. Some of the big media magazines are championing diversity. So it is getting better. But I think there's a subconscious bias that people are just unaware of. So I have been advised by government mentors that it's unrealistic of me to expect investors to invest in me leading an engineering company. And I, why would that be? Oh, it's just, you know, people just don't expect that. And it's, you know, challenging those sorts of positions. And yet it's subconscious, so there's no awareness of it. But I would say that in Scotland, it's much, much easier working with men who really recognise and own their subconscious bias. It's been fantastic, actually.
Interesting. And talking of men, you're actually working with your husband as well, I understand. So how's that going? And was that a sort of conscious choice, or was he just the best man for the job?
It's a bit of both, really. I mean, we've been working on this project since about, the end of last century. He's a financial general management expert. He's worked and turned around and a lot of small companies and sold them on to big investors, and they've gone on to make a big difference. And the previous company he worked for was a renewable energy company, so he's got a lot of excellent qualifications. Also, that work enabled us to, you know, pay the mortgage and keep the lights on. So very, very strong supporter of the project, has it imbued in his, you know, DNA, for better or worse, but also has the skill set to manage the numbers, because, you know, the finance arrangements with grant funding is incredibly challenging to manage, because you don't get paid your grant until you've paid out the big number. So if you're spending millions of pounds on metal items, you have to find the funds to do that before you get some of the funding back. And that creates a really interesting cash flow challenge. So you need a super excellent financial visionary to be able to do that. And I think that that's what he brings, along with general management experience and building good teams and so on.
Now we're coming towards the end. It's a cheeky last question. I was reading an article that you'd done for UKTN, actually, talking about how founders, you know, should pass the baton on to a new chief executive as soon as possible. But you're both founder and chief executive. So when do you think you will need to pass the baton on, and how do you sort of know when that time is right?
So I think I know that I have a function, which is to start up the company, and that it is really important for me to recognise that I can step away from some of the day-to-day management, that being self-aware that, you know, my skill set is not necessarily the detail of setting up a company, because some of that doesn't really interest me that much. And so I think it's really important. But I have to balance that with investors who want the visionary founder to be around. So I'm working with, as I said, the International Futures Forum to kind of manage that transition. And I'm holding Jürgen Klopp as my, you know, model for doing that. Yeah, I'd like to put somebody who's got more youth and energy, who knows how to plug their headset into their laptop quickly and easily, those sorts of things, while still being, forgive the pun, but a guiding hand on the tiller.
Well, we didn't have too many sailing puns, did we, during this interview, which is a shame. I regret that now. I think we should have had a few more. But it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you, Diane Gilpin. Thank you for joining me. And thank you to everyone, of course, who's listening. We will be back with another episode next week. But in the meantime, you can keep up to date with all the latest UK tech developments at www.uktech.news. Don't forget to follow UKTN on LinkedIn and X, where you can also get in touch with me with your comments and suggestions about the show. Until next time, goodbye from me. HSBC Innovation Banking, our partner for this episode, provides commercial banking services, expertise, and insights to the technology, life science and healthcare, private equity, and venture capital industries. To find out why innovation needs different, go to www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb.